Blog Talk Radio.
Looks like we're shy of one horse.
You brought too many.
Thank you.
November 24th, show number 1503. Welcome as we take time to give thanks in more ways than one on this edition of Soul Tree Radio on the Raw. I'm your host, Michael Losing, DJ Honeycomb from Total Music Concepts LTD. And as always, it is good to have you in the house. Soul Tree Radio on the Raw, proudly sponsored by BASNNewsroom.com. And the Assassins of the Black Athlete Sports Network. Get all the good shit. The who, what, when, where, why, and how, right now at www.basnnewsroom.com. Shout out to the members of the Brother Man Network who may be appearing here, Yehiva and Yon, Radio Reggie and Russ, and Radio Reggie in Richmond, Virginia. Pat Freeman of Mighty Obar, Western New York. Our brothers and colleagues at the African American Athlete, Tim, Mike, and Ricky Hampton. Excuse me here. Sonic Cheryl, still recuperating. Love you and get better, sweetie. Along with the old man, little Ledbetter out of Philly. And, of course, with me as always, Bad Man from the East Bay, Gary Norris Gray. What's up, G?
Man, we got to stop this nonsense. Over the weekend, over $80,000 of merchandise was sold in the Bay Area this weekend.
Oh, I saw that. That was wild.
It continued today.
What happened? They hit another mall?
Yeah, in Peters. Michael, I don't know what this is.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know where this is coming from.
Mm-hmm.
But this is bad. This is bad news.
Give me.
If you're going shopping, you're in the middle of this.
Mm-hmm.
How do you get away?
That's the question. Set it up for us, G. Tell everybody who we are, and let's carry on from there.
BlackAthlete.com. Looking for the definitive source for information? BlackAthlete.com, that's where it's at. From Jackie Robinson, Muhammad Ali, to Michael Jordan and Shaq, football, basketball, baseball, and everything in between, we focus on all the major players and stories. Daily features, video on demand, Black Athlete newspapers coming to a city near you. Tired of the same old sports programming? Check out BlackAthlete.com. Sports the way you like it.
Start BASN.
Yes, sir. We are BASN.
Okay, do you remember two years ago, they did the same thing in every film. But
okay,
what, what they didn't tell you 2 years ago, was young white men broke the windows first.
Ah, okay.
And then young black men went in the doors.
Mm-hmm.
Now, this guy, that didn't happen. This guy was a full-out scale rubble.
Okay, well, hold on, Gary. Set this up for some of us East Coast folks who think there's a difference in how the East and West vibe. You know, set this up. I mean, is this something that was expected? Did this become in vogue recently? What's what with this?
No, okay. What I think happened was they believe that the verdicts of these last two trials
We're going to
set America off, and it didn't, right?
Yeah, yeah.
So these young guys, wherever they are, went to San Francisco, went to Oakland, and went to San Jose, and raided these doors.
So did this start in San Jose or San Francisco or Oakland?
Well, it started in San Francisco. That's where it started.
Okay. All right.
Yeah, move to San Jose. And then she was like, Oakland today. So whoever, okay, this has been going for a while because Walgreens lock up everything because it's still no matter Walgreens.
Walgreens?
Do you mean they bought everything? It's crazy. Why would you take lotion, shampoo, I mean, this is stupid stuff, Michael.
Well, you know, hold up. It's not that stupid, G, because it all depends on what they think is important. And we got Tony McClain with us right now raising his hand. Tony, are you there?
Yeah, I'm here.
Oh, okay.
Can you hear me?
Well, yeah, it looks like you got your hand raised. I'm like, okay. You know, seriously, it's like, oh, my Horseshack and
oh,
shit.
No,
I was ready to say,
no,
okay.
I'm just listening. Mm-hmm.
But gentlemen, my concern is that young people are going to get hurt by this.
Well,
people have no business in it, no grudge at all with this.
Yeah.
Because once you start doing this, all bets are off.
Well, that remains to be seen, Gary, because we've seen this before. You know, there have been shoplifting teams going in the stores taking shit. It's more of a methodology now. You know, it's been more thought out. And if you go into a high-end mall, yeah, it's more likely that the mall will be a target because of what they're selling there. I mean, if they got Louis Vuitton and other shit in the mall, then yeah.
Well, they're targeting Macy's. All the big guys
I'm not saying this hasn't been done before. I just haven't seen something like that hit this hard on the East Coast. Tony, you're on the East Coast with me. Have you ever seen shoplifting teams do damage to a mall and snatch shit up?
Not physically. I've heard of it. Now, is the premise are they using the premise of the verdicts or the possibility of the verdicts coming out within the last week or so? Well, here's the thing.
Mm-hmm.
It just goes to show you that nothing's changed in the sense of here's the thing. As we saw in Ferguson and in these other quote-unquote places where quote-unquote riots broke out,
yep.
There were white folks that
yep.
played at King, that were breaking in, and they
That's
would
right.
leave a BL and they would leave a BLM. Thing.
Yep.
And of
That's
course,
right.
it would be reported that it was all black folks. And see,
yeah.
I truly think this is I didn't hear all what you were saying, but I got the gist of it. But
mm-hmm.
see, nothing's changed, you know.
Yeah.
Even with Mo, Larry, and Curly being being convicted today,
yeah.
they're still gonna try to victimize the victims in the sense
you're right
in the sense of they're gonna try to play it out that oh there's all the riots are breaking out and these stores are going to quote unquote close because of the violence and all this other
of course
stuff. But see again cause and effect if they didn't kill this guy. You wouldn't have this happening.
Hello.
If Wittenhouse didn't, him and his mama drive all the way, we wouldn't be in this situation. But again, it's always easier to blame the victims. You know, I mean, they it never, it, you know, I unfortunately, it's become something that I put on Facebook way too. It never ends. Even with a guilty or not guilty verdict, it never ends because we're still being persecuted as a people. I mean, you know, thankfully, you know, the Aubrey family got justice, but unfortunately, the folks in Wisconsin didn't get justice, and then you had the subsequent thing as well. But see, again, cause and effect. I mean, you don't have to be, you know, you don't have to be a rocket scientist here. And also, you see how the way that they're going to depict stuff as well.
That's right.
Because and you know, look, they've been jumping from, you know, this is no different from the OJ verdict or the Diallo verdict or the Sean Bell verdict or the Rodney King verdict. End of the day, it's still us being victimized.
That's right.
It's very interesting because OBD has been on the internet, right? It wasn't the internet. And these morons put what they were going to do on the internet.
Of course they did.
Just like they. Just like the folks at the January 6th riot. You look at if you check the internet on the 5th, they're all, you know, Bannon and all these other folks are basically out there saying, you know, pain train's coming. Be prepared.
That's right.
And now these are the same ones that are saying, oh, it wasn't premeditated.
Oh, yeah. Really? Oh, yeah.
The same folks that will pull a Kevin Hart tweet from 20 fucking years ago, all of a sudden can't find the tweet from the day before of all these people saying, we are going to riot tomorrow. Get ready.
Hello. That's right. And before we say anything further, we have to see this for what it is. You know, first of all, the guy gets shot minding his own business jogging in the neighborhood. Three crackers come up on him. And they're going to supposedly enforce a citizen's arrest.
Yeah.
And they decide to arrest him by blowing his fucking brains out with a shotgun. And then,
where have we heard this before?
I know. Some of you heard this before.
Sunrise, Florida, by any chance?
Come on. Yep. Not just one, but two waves of police interaction are nullified because one cunt decides that she can't do anything, and then when she's busted for not doing anything, she recuses herself. And then after all of that, another one who comes in after the fact says, well, we don't think these guys did anything wrong. So they had to climb through a hill of bullshit and banality and bellicose nonsense before they would get a fair shake from the jury. 11 white people and one black person. And if you think the colors and the numbers are upsetting, yeah, you should. You know, Emmett Till got tried in 2 hours, less than 2 hours, and he was murdered. And if his own mama didn't say, let anybody see what they did to my boy, the true effect of that would not have lasted. And on top of everything else, those cocksuckers who killed him were paid $75 by Look Magazine to get their account of what the fuck they did to Emmett Till. And that bitch pulled out on this happen. She's so fucking alive.
Later.
Yes, I know. I made her fucking nasty, rotted, carved up corpse of eggs roast in fucking hell for the shit that she did because she knew she did it. Everybody knew she did it. And they allowed an environment where they could get away with it. And you know people were thinking about things like that in Georgia when this decision was going to come through. I know those crackers believed they were actually going to get off.
They really believed it. And, you know, Michael, what bothered me about this whole thing?
What?
Is that when the going gets tough, When they get caught in the corner,
yep,
always run to the legal book. always run through the Constitution.
What's this quote attributed to Mark Twain? The last bastion of a coward is patriotism.
Yes.
Come on.
Yes.
Or in this case, the legal system. So
that's right.
One minute they want to be Charles Manson, then the next minute they want to be Clarence fucking Darrow. And
hello.
You know,
that's a good analogy.
You can't have it both ways. But unfortunately, the legal system is always going to allow them to do that.
That's what bothered me with anything else. Is that you know you're dead wrong. I mean,
It's the lack of accountability because
that's right.
The thing is, and see, they're convicted, but see, now what are they going to do? They're going to spend the next how much or whatever to try to overturn the conviction. They're going to try to say that, you know,
that's
I wouldn't be surprised if they say, oh, we couldn't get a legal, we couldn't get a fair trial here. Or, I mean, they were trying to, remember, the fact that they trotted out Jesse Jackson's ass and Al Sharpton or whoever else was coming on there, they tried to do a mistrial off of that.
Oh yeah, no black bastards. They meant to say no black bastards, but I digress. You know what's happening here is something our parents went through and something our parents feared. And as our parents worried for our little asses when we were too young not to know, we also knew we were going to grow up inheriting not guilt, but the understanding that this system is not wired for us. And we're all we got. Literally, I ain't talking about no fucking football team. This is the issue at hand. It hasn't changed. And for everybody that wants to jump up and go, hark, hallelujah, because they got guilty verdicts on three people, you know, you're missing the boat. Listen, that little motherfucker who got off is walking around like the cock of the walk. He is going to be lauded and applauded by the white supremacists who were backing him up. Like, he even said now that he didn't know that sign was a white power sign. Like, come on, get the fuck. Get the entire fuck out of here. This is what we're dealing with. And if black people think we caught a break because somebody did what they were fucking supposed to do and put these motherfuckers in jail, you got another thing coming. There's still the federal trial. This is a hate crime, and it needs to be tried under hate crime law. So all of those motherfuckers, you have to kill them and bring them back to life so you can fucking kill them again, I say do so. But make no bones about it. Ironically, this evening we were going to, and we still will, talk about what-if scenarios. And they had to do with sports, obviously, but this is a what-if scenario too, gentlemen. I mean, what if those motherfuckers went free? What the fuck do you think would happen to Georgia, much less most other places?
I believe, Michael, the last 5 years, they've been aching for a fight.
Somebody's been scared for a fight,
I need to do this. And my fears don't never come to fruition because we can't win that battle.
Some people would think so, but from an individual battle, you know, it'd be one of those, I ain't going alone. So if I do go, I'm taking somebody with me. And
remember the line from the Untouchables. You know, they send one of yours to the hospital, you send three of theirs to the morgue. And look, mm-hmm. I get it. I know there's going to be people that's going to be like, you know, eye for eye, tooth for tooth, or whatever, and it all leaves us,
yep.
you know, blind. But see, here's the thing.
Mm-hmm.
The one thing that's always, the one consistent thing that has always happened in situations like that is that we, as black people, are always the ones that are getting
always. Blamed. That's right.
And it's, you know, they only, you know, the sad thing is we need to take out a few of our work. See, we need to take out some of them too, because then maybe they'll
be left. Mm-hmm.
See,
yeah.
The fact that him and his mama and guys like George Zimmerman are still roaming
mm-hmm.
the street, it doesn't make
yeah.
up for. It doesn't make up for the Floyd, you know, it doesn't make up for the Floyd verdict. It doesn't
no.
make up for this verdict at all.
In no way does it make up for
allowed, yeah, they're because
mm-hmm.
they're still allowed to live. And see, we,
this
you know, our whole, he should, you know, at the very least, he should have gone to jail. But see, when they basically threw away the gun charge, it was a
yeah.
wrap, because that was basically the basis of the trial.
Exactly.
Once you basically took away,
how can you throw away a gun charge when you see the kid walking with the gun, when you see him having shot people with the gun? You know, all of that flies in the face. And I talk about this whenever we see a courtroom. You know, you don't even bother going in because you know that bitch is blind. She's got a fucking blindfold on before they hold court in there. So we know that the game is rigged. But to start with that what if. What if has now become true? What if this motherfucker got charged? Maybe the tension would be calmer. But no. They killed two people. The fact that they were white didn't change the plan that they're still dead. And they didn't care. Oh, the young man, he had a bad day. And because he had a bad day, two people lost their lives. But you better believe they think they're slick and trying to gloss him as some asshole said, a young man, a young rightly man, defending blah, blah, blah. Well, no, all you did was turn this little motherfucker into a pariah. He better stay strapped because somebody will burn his ass. And I won't be surprised if and when that happens, that they do. Mm-hmm. You can't walk around with protection all the time. And you better believe, it's not a threat. It's just a statement of a situation. You did what you did knowing what you did. Your mother did it for you. She drove you to that motherfucker. So she aided and abetted. And a decent prosecutor would have been able to hold her for the charge of that, but did not do so. So there's a whole lot of leftover material that we're going to have to deal with. And the what ifs will now manifest in different ways that just us casually talking about sports and research. Now the what ifs blow up even bigger. Because
Michael, this goes right back to the Zimmerman case.
Yeah.
Now it's moved he was the judge and jury. All right. He'd walk around following this young kid and he killed this young man.
Mm-hmm.
He gets aid to do so.
Of course.
Now, if the roles were reversed,
mm-hmm.
that boy would be in jail for eternity. I mean eternity.
Okay. He'd be doing time, because he'd be
time
doing
and half.
Time. Yeah.
And see,
yeah.
that system...
Mm-hmm.
America has a superior attitude, Gary, in order to be broken, because if it's not broken, we're going to repeat this scenario over and over again.
Well, Gary, in order for it to be broken, you have to be willing to change. And there's no desire to change something they made a point of putting in place, so that it stays, you know, status quo forever and ever. Amen.
Yes.
Now, let me get the professor in the middle of this, because, you know, professor, okay, we heard the verdict. We saw some of the counts. And the fact that this happened in Georgia, you know, put a different spin on it. But, you know, you're North Kakalaki. I'm sure people are paying attention to it down there. What's your vibe all in all with this, and good evening?
Well, good evening. I haven't really talked to very many people. This is kind of a slow day as far as running into people. I've had a couple people take a couple swings at it. And I think I heard somebody say that if the role reversed, and I think they were talking in the situation of that a little gentleman from up north. Well, the best way I can describe that particular situation would be in the case where Trayvon Martin or the young man had a little 12-year-old with a toy gun in the park. He was shot by a cop. I would venture to say that if the roles were reversed, well, Trayvon Martin got killed.
Yep.
The young man up in Indiana got killed.
Mm-hmm.
No repercussion to the cop. And in my humble opinion, at the distance that that young man was from the cop when the cop shot him,
mm-hmm.
cop judgment is that bad. He don't deserve a gun.
Exactly.
You know, and the
Trayvon Martin only 3 seconds.
He never pointed a gun at the cop.
No,
but that's beside the point.
Mm-hmm.
The one thing I would say, because I just April 1, Ryan has posted the reading of the verdict online.
Mm-hmm.
If you want to see it, if y'all need to see it again, on Facebook. And the charge I did not hear or see was being the dumbest bastards that have to walk the earth. Because to me, their best, the prosecution's best witness, we're all parents, and we know what it's like when your kid do something stupid.
Right.
And you want to go, Lord, please.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Never forget some comedian used to, one of Burt Reynolds movies with Jackie Gleason, you know,
yes.
when I get home, I'm going to slap the hell out of your mama.
I was talking to Manny. That shit was funny. Yeah.
Now, Pops was sitting there like, please tell me, you know, please tell me my wife screwed around on me on that night and that he is not mine. And and then the goofy neighbor, the one, you know,
mm-hmm.
the other one who helped the prosecution by filming all of this.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
He was in there, of all the neighbors that could have chosen or could have chosen me,
mm-hmm.
or I just stumbled upon, I had to pick these two idiots to be complicit in a murder. You know, he got up on about a third of the charges, but like I said, the one charge I didn't hear was just being the dumbest, three of the dumbest white people to walk the earth lately, because
but you know.
Every time the son answered a question, he helped.
Mm-hmm.
You know, didn't he run for you 3 times? Yes. Well, when were you threatened? Well,
exactly.
You know, it was like he had my gun. No, the video said he didn't have your gun. You and even at the time there was a confrontation, at the point at the point where he was in range to get the gun, you know,
yep.
it's like you had the gun. So
mm-hmm.
at no point, you know, if you got the gun, that outweighs anything he could possibly do to you.
This was a classic case. A classic case of crackers being crackers. And when they got exposed, nobody in this case should have been surprised at what the result was. But we are surprised because how often is there really justice with this system as rigged as it is? You know, I as much as I understand people's elation in feeling that the brother got justice and maybe now his soul can rest in peace, I'm still pissed because I know the depth that they went to in trying to avoid them even having a case in the first place and having legal professionals paid by the state or the county or whatever to allow the process to go on, two police, so-called police professionals pass this shit on. Well, you know, they're white folks. Just let it go. It's a dead nigga. We don't have to worry about that shit. I mean, that was the basic attitude they had. And it didn't change. It doesn't even change with the verdict. It's like, well, what's my crack ass going to do now? I mean, am I missing something here?
No, and see, what's worse is that basically Mr. Aubrey was basically murdered twice. Because
exactly.
his character
yes.
got assassinated again, and the
mm-hmm.
mother and the family had to go through all of that again, and see, you know, there's at some point, again, this is the whole thing of us as black folks basically having to deal with our own PTSD, because
exactly.
Even with the guilty verdict, there's always going to be a specter of, well, if the kid wasn't there, he wouldn't have had, you know, it was still going to be,
mm-hmm.
it was still going to come back to, well, if he hadn't been there, it wouldn't have been no whatever. And it's like,
that's exactly right.
You know, again, it just doesn't end. And you know, and when it plays out in the specter of the big story, because see, here's the thing, there's a better chance of these folks that rioted in January 6th not doing time as opposed to. They're not going to get them all. I mean, they got some of them,
okay.
what have you.
Mm-hmm.
But they've already indirectly made martyrs out of them.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess now they're going after Bannon and Stone
right.
and Trump, what have you. But
mm-hmm.
the crime's already been done.
Yeah,
the crime's already done. I agree. You know, go after them, but they're not. You know, the perpetrators of this. The real perpetrators of this aren't really going to do a whole lot of time.
No,
they're
not.
Tony, what they did was threaten the very democracy with this dead war.
You got to remember. They don't recognize the democracy.
If you say you're a democracy,
yes.
If you're telling me you're a democracy, and you allow this to happen, shame on you.
Well, no, they've never recognized the democracy from day one.
Thank you. They didn't, and they wouldn't. And the funny part about it is, it doesn't really matter what part of the country it is. This could have happened in New York. This could have happened in Ohio or Washington State or whatever.
It did lay out the same scenario. It did happen in New York. Remember the young man that was on his way into his house and the cops roll up and shoot him?
That's right.
20 times.
Sean Bell.
Yeah.
Sean Bell.
That's right.
or the cop uses the cop used the chokehold on somebody, and it was a
Pennsylvania, whatever his name was, Trickier Garner.
Who the perpetrator is, you know, I say now the reverse of that is this idiot over the weekend who drove into this parade, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, so which tells me, okay, we're not without our own bunch of idiots, too.
Exactly.
My thinking there was, first of all, how the hell he get out of jail on $1,000 bond?
You.
He could have, you
no
know.
Shit.
Hey, you have a DA right here in San Jose DA who refuses to put people in jail.
Mm-hmm. She should go out to her ass.
What kind of message are you sending? If you do not put people in jail, Robert, so as reported, this is going on in the Bay Area right now.
I think you're referring to, Gary, are you referring to the guy who confessed first-degree rape and the judge said, oh, he had a bad day, you know, let him go, because if he ends up in jail, you know, they'll butt-fuck him and all kinds of crazy shit. And
yeah.
So his life will be somewhat interrupted. Yeah, that's what I'm talking
about. San Jose.
Unbelievable.
This has been going on for years.
Mm-hmm. Well, this is the Dred Scott mentality that we're dealing with, because ultimately the court says there's no law for a black man that a white man is supposed to respect. So there's a disdain that comes with this, and it's had centuries in the making before it actually got here. So now as they apply this, just like they tried to make this mealy-mouth argument about the citizens arrest law that was on the books in Georgia, you know, trying to be the glue that would save their cracker asses from getting fried in the electric chair. No, that didn't do it. But make no bones about it. There are laws on the books. We've seen them. We've seen interpretations of them by judges. And this is where their book is like the Bible, because it's subject to interpretation. Somebody can say something fucking outlandish, and all they need to do is get one person to believe it. And you have reasonable doubt, and that motherfucker will go free.
That's been the one scenario that's played out in all of this.
Mm-hmm.
Involving us as black folks.
Yeah,
we don't get justice. We get it in in spurts, but we don't get we don't get complete justice. And that's to me, that's always the problem. You know,
I don't want to be in a position where, all right, my fucking life's gonna end behind some bullshit. We all gotta go, but I don't want to go behind no bullshit. So if it comes down to a scenario where, hey, if I take someone with me, I won't feel so bad. That's what it's come down to. I think a lot of people are feeling this way because of something we've known has been happening and building for the last 5-6 years. And that is the fact that in this country, the landscape is getting a lot darker. There are a lot more folks that look like you, me, Fred, and Gary now here. And they realize that there's less folks like those three cracker-ass motherfuckers who are there. And in another 5-10 years, it's going to get darker still. And while they may not be able to say, we got to do something about this and call this herd, the mindset will be there. So we're looking at something that we already know is going to take effect. The question is, how do we react to it, and what do we do about it when confronted with it? You know, there is no stand your ground law for black folks.
And the hardest thing, like, is that we're never allowed to really rest.
No, that's it. Thank you.
We can never rest.
And physically.
That's exactly
really,
in a nutshell.
That's the thing here, because, you know, I think I can speak for everybody when I say this.
Mm-hmm.
We're tired because it's just
that's
it's
right.
Like the minute, you know, because see, the minute something, you know, you get quote unquote a verdict sort of like this, something else will crop up.
Yes.
Or
you hit it right on the head.
Just,
tired.
Yeah. It just becomes
it
a thing
takes
of,
energy.
Yeah.
See,
and
why my niece say that we are all that all black people are suffering from PTSD.
Yeah,
in spite of the fact that we have a quote lieutenant governor here who said that
mm-hmm.
that's impossible, and he also says that there's no such thing as systemic racism.
Yeah.
But maybe you know. He gets up in churches and preach sermons about this.
Are you kidding? Jesus, man.
No, I kid thee not.
Well,
you know,
that's and see, the sad thing is his kind is nothing new, because see, that's how they, you know, and I know this is going to piss people off, but I don't care. People
mm-hmm.
use the church as a way to pacify us. Look,
maybe.
we all believe in, you know, God or what have you and anything like that, but even God says you got to defend yourself.
Come on,
you know, and see that whole thing, and see what's sad is that him and other folks like him, whether they be male or female, that's a long-standing tradition going back, you know the Willie Lynch stuff or how
yep.
the nigga feel, nigga whatever, you know,
and mm-hmm.
see what's kind of sad is. You know, Malcolm lost his daughter earlier this week. And, you know, I can't help but think that, and, you know, forgive me for being paranoid, but I can't help but think that somebody killed her. And
mm-hmm.
it's literally and figuratively going to get lost in the sauce because,
that's right.
oh, well, because of, you know, how they feel about Malcolm, she deserves to,
mm-hmm.
you know, she deserves to,
yeah.
no matter, you know, no matter what we do, no matter how much of a citizen we try to be as black folks, there's always going to be that, well, you know, there's always that but or whatever. You know, anything and everything we do is always devalued, even if we're
mm-hmm.
just living our lives.
Yeah.
It does not change. We know it does not change. And the fact that we have to confront this, either softly or harshly, is what zaps the juice out of us. I remember Cornel West talking about this at a symposium at the University of Pennsylvania. I was actually there, and we were talking on a myriad of subjects. But the whole point was, you know, we build up this energy to survive. Then, as parents, and we're all parents here, we have to worry about our kids, you know, especially the boys, but the girls too. I mean, I got three.
Yeah.
And as we do this, we see the weight shift from one problem to another, whether it's societally, whether it's on the job, whether it's with the people they're dealing with from a personal level, you know, and you have to knock for Micah to say, you know, shit, at least it's not that bad. I don't have to worry about my girls in toxic relationships or stuff like that. But then that toxicity spreads to the society at large. You know, you got to get all geared up worrying about whether or not your kids going to make it home, because these motherfuckers out here have decided that they can do whatever the fuck they want, how they want. And this is the mentality that we go to sleep with the knots. Until we hear or we see that our kids are all right. Because we know we don't want to be in that situation where, God forbid, you have to make a life-altering decision.
And in some cases, you're going to have to alter someone else's life, probably with some power tools, if you know what I'm saying. And then your life has changed. But that arc is something we have to all deal with, and we all end up on it once we become parents. And it does not let up until we know the parents are adults and can handle their own weight. And by that time, we're so damn old, we don't care. I digress.
Well, I'm glad you brought that up.
Mm-hmm.
Because my Chinese daughter,
mm-hmm,
and her first boyfriend this month, her first boyfriend,
mm-hmm,
I'm thinking, okay, all right, I got to watch what this boy is doing.
Right.
And what are you saying, right?
Mm-hmm.
One, because this girl has no clue about what guys can and can't do.
Mm-hmm.
And she has no clue whatsoever because she come from, mm-hmm, China.
Right.
So I have to watch her for the next 6 months until she gets her feet on the ground. It's like we should not be... Why should I be worried about this woman for the next 3 months over this guy?
It's craziness.
Unfortunately,
it goes with the territory.
That's right.
It's like it could be. How does she? She's
30. She's her first boyfriend. 30 years old.
30 years old. Well, that's a whole different dimension right there.
That's a two-drink conversation, Gary.
That's a two-hour.
Yeah, this guy is an older guy too.
Like,
oh boy, here we go.
Gary, you got to remember though, there's certain rules that go with that. No matter how old they are, because. As my sister used to say, that's still my baby.
Yeah,
that's right.
Remember when we were talking about several situations when some kid get hurt on the field out there, I don't care how rough and tough tackle or guard or defensive lineman or linebacker, all that stuff. Hey, when you see him spread out on the field.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
that's somebody's baby. That's your baby.
Right.
You see, like in my case, my stepdaughter is all of, and I quote her, she's 5 feet tall,
mm-hmm,
10 or less, but she's 5 feet tall. Now she's married, mm-hmm, to a dude that's 6'5", which,
mm-hmm,
quite in 6'5". But one of the rules that I learned from one of my mentors was, hey, he don't roll up in the car, toot the horn, and you go running out.
Mm-hmm.
You got to come in.
Mm-hmm.
And see, you always, for those situations, you always be cleaning your gun.
Yep.
Because more so in today's environment than when we came up.
Mm-hmm.
Let's see. I wouldn't have been. Let's see, Mr. West. Let's see, who had a daughter. Yeah, Mr.
Mm-hmm.
West had a daughter who is like 2 or 3 years younger than me, right? Ain't
mm-hmm.
no way. You know, he was a trustee of the church, local businessman. Well, most of the people where I lived were businessmen because they were farmers.
Right.
Now, you know, from time to time, we knew what, you know, when you go out and you say you harvest peanuts or beans or whatever,
mm-hmm.
you have an influx of partridges or whatever,
right,
birds that you want to go hunting. Squirrels,
mm-hmm.
all that kind of stuff. That rabbits, all that kind of stuff.
Critters, yeah.
So over the years, coming up to, say, 10 to 12 years of age, I done been out in the field and see this joker shoot. So right. And I know one bang, one bird. You know, that's how you shoot. One bang, one rabbit. One bang, one. And so I know this guy can shoot. He, you know, all shotguns mm-hmm. with 12 gauge. Mm-hmm. Rifles might be 22,
well,
might be 30, 7.65, whatever. You know, but I done seen this guy shoot. You know, Mr. McCloud with his fine daughters. Because, as a matter of fact, it was kind of funny with him because, like, he was a preacher. And his wife was a preacher, and his wife was the one to pull the gun on this white guy who said her, told her, asked her not to put her children on the bus with his children to go to the at that time, the integrating, formerly all white school. And his wife said, if you hear when I get back out here, I'm going to shoot you. Get out of my yard. But, you know, some of the things that we learn almost by osmosis, we have to teach children now because there's this idea that, you know, because I remember a couple of my both of my kids' friends, you know, they're some of them, you know, they were in, you know, well, my son was in a jazz band. They're like 19, 20 kids in the jazz band, one black, one Japanese. The concert band, there were about 50 of them. There was about a dozen maybe black kids. He was one of them. And so you get these quote-unquote white friends. Some of them cool. Some of them crazy. And, you know, just looking at the rapper, you can't tell who's what. And, you know, this is why my aunt used to say, I don't care how old my children get, to the day I draw my last breath, I'm going to pray for my children. I'm down with all that because I have seen, here's what we're dealing with. It's like we like to talk about having to talk with our kids. But what do we tell them? Because, see, the prevailing problem is we don't know which side of the bed this particular cop got up on today.
That's right.
And no matter what we talk to them about, there is no catch. There's no one size fit all for these nut cases. And they always throw this one under the bus. Well, you know, all cops aren't bad. No, they're not. The cops that are good won't turn in the ones that's bad. And you have a system that says if you do, you're not a real cop. You have cops who tell think about it in the last 2-3 years. We have had cops. Well, no, this is the last 2 years with the vaccine situation. Oh, we ain't taking no shots.
That's
so
right.
And what are they telling us now? The biggest spreads are coming from people who have not been vaccinated. Quiet as it has been kept, it popped up on TV on Meet the Press a few weeks ago. Do you realize more cops have died from COVID in the last year than have died in the line of duty otherwise?
Well, I believe that.
5 years.
Yep. I believe that. I mean, 700,000 dead folks can't be wrong, and unfortunately, it ain't wrong. But
my prevailing question is this: how are you going to enforce the law with people who are telling you they're going to break it?
Yes, exactly, and that's what the government is talking about.
These fools are picking and choosing which one they're going to go against.
They've literally and figuratively have made it a political issue now. And I think all of us are in that I wish a motherfucker would in regards to take that mask off.
Pretty much. And this is what Leah was alluding to. When I was talking to her before she came on the show, she was shaking her head at all the times these
stupid motherfuckers would come into emergency, and she's dealing with them through triage, and they're fucking with them because they know they're supposed to have a mask on. And Leah asking them, you know, as nicely as possible, you know, can you blah, blah, blah. And, you know, I would fear her in a wish a motherfucker mode even more, but I know she had medical tools to deal with them and shit, maybe knock them the fuck out. But in Alberta, they have lost their bunny rabbit blinking mind. You got a lot of nutty motherfuckers making nutty motherfucking decisions, and it's affecting.
It's not just Alberta. It's not just Alberta. It's all over. I'm sure you got them where Fred's at. You got them where Gary's at. You got them here where I'm at, and where you're at. Stupidity is not a prejudice club. It takes all time.
Yeah, you're right about that. I will end this with what Fred was speaking on regarding that polishing of the gun. You know, I'm no churchgoer, but I was in church long enough to know that one should be slow to take offense but always ready for reconciliation. And I think that's pretty much the mindset of all of us on this trip. Now, because we do want to go, what if tonight, in a more positive and pleasant vein, I want to start that by going to a conversation that Tony and I had Monday when we set up our Monday meeting. And, you know, the whole what if scenario, it's been done, you know, comic books and movies and shows about it and stuff like that. But I like where sometimes the research can spiral. And Tony laid one on me that I thought was kind of cool. You know, what if Johnny Unitas? Now, finish the sentence, Tony, because I want to make sure I have it right. What were we saying regarding Johnny Unitas?
Well, I was roaming Facebook, and it was on one of the NFL.
The 1950-59 page.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And it had a picture of an obscure quarterback out of the University of Louisville by the name of Johnny Unitas. In 1955 Pittsburgh Steelers uniform. Now, everybody knows the story of Johnny Unitas, you know, great player out of the University of Louisville, was drafted in the ninth round by the Pittsburgh Steelers, like the 100-and-something pick overall. When he was in camp, he was in camp with other quarterbacks, and eventually the Steelers kept a then young Ted Marchibroda. Yes, that same Ted Marchibroda that would go on to coach the Colts. That made the stat. Matter of fact, there were two other guys who basically, I'm not even gonna say they had a cup of coffee. I think they had a half a glass of Kool-Aid with the Steelers that season. But the whole thing was, the premise was basically, if Johnny Unitas, you know, makes the Steelers a ball club, do they not go 42 damn years without, you know, winning their first championship or at the very least, make the playoff? Because, let's face it, the name escapes me who wound up being the quarterback. I'm sorry. The starting quarterback that year, ironically, for the Pittsburgh Steelers in 1955, if you're familiar with football, was a guy by the name of Jim Finks. And Jim Finks was may be known more so for his days as a GM than as a player.
That's right.
He actually was GM for the, for the Vikings for the 70s to early 80s Bears. And he ended his career with the Saints in the late 80s. He was the starting quarterback year for the 55 Steelers. Spoiler alert: they stuck. Just to say that. Unitas gets cut at training camp. He plays semi-pro ball that year. Gets invited to the Colts training camp the next year, and you know the rest is history. But I mean, to me, when I saw the picture, I just basically said, "Here's a what if," that we can talk about for a show down the road.
because I think, needless to say, you know, if the Steelers have kept one of the best quarterbacks of all time, arguably the best, which is another 2-3 hour conversation in and of itself. I think it's safe to say the Steelers' fortunes might have changed just a tad bit, and maybe there would have been a steel curtain a little bit sooner than the 70s.
Yeah. I mean, think about Unitas and what he did and how the difference between somebody assessing talent and getting it really, really right or really, really wrong ain't much. And back then in 1955, the draft was buck wild. I mean, what was it, 30 rounds? Something like that, yeah.
He was drafted in the ninth. Officially, he was drafted in the ninth round. I want to say, what was it, Mike? Like 190th something pick?
I think there were like 350 people in that whole draft.
Yeah.
It was like 30 rounds, something.
Well, it was 30. See, that's the thing that got me. It was 30 rounds. I mean, what is it now? Seven in the NFL now? And I also, the thing which was also kind of cool in checking that out, some of the other notable players of that draft, there were some notable HBCU players. The quarterback the longtime
quarterback. Brackens was drafted in that draft
by the Green Bay Packers. He was, ironically, he was the fourth quarterback picked in that draft. Some of the other notables, Ralph Guglielmi from Notre Dame, and
backed up
also,
a title in the air.
But from that draft, you also had Rosie Grier wound up being drafted by the New York Giants, of course. But one of the most interesting picks came in the 30th round. The fifth pick in the 30th round, which wound up being, I think, like about the 300 and something of pick, there was back from the University of San Francisco by the name of Casey Jones. And yes, that being Casey Jones from, you know, USF fame, Boston Celtics fame, and what have you. He was drafted, he was drafted by the Rams. So it was like a territorial pick, so to speak.
Yeah.
Because the Rams took him out of USF. I think the Niners were still around, but I guess for whatever.
You're breaking up, Tony.
I'm breaking
up a little bit. Try it again.
How about now? Is that better?
You're still garbled.
These freaking headphones.
Can you hear me now?
I can hear you. Yes.
Oh, okay. Yeah. It literally started as a Google search because I just, when we were show prepping, I just had to know who these other guys, who these other quarterbacks that got picked ahead of Unitas, and also just how good how bad the Steelers were that year, where Johnny Unitas couldn't even break the roster for them. But yeah, it's interesting, and it actually led to another one which we'll get to a little bit later. In regards to that. But yeah, the Unitas one was interesting in the sense because, again, it was literally sort of a throwaway picture of seeing him in that Steeler, uniform. I mean, the thing about it is he looked a lot better in that Steeler uniform than he did that last year playing for the Chargers.
You were a kid. But you know what, fellas? It's interesting how these scenarios – it's like putting those dominoes down and hitting one and having them all fall and spill into all different types of situations. Now, we got to remember, back in 65, Gail Sayers was the shit. And nobody knew that he was the shit, although we had a hint. When he was playing college ball at the University of Kansas, ABC did a special on him. It was called The Gale from Kansas. And this has been the first time in a while that someone who was not a quarterback and definitely a black guy was getting some light. We were wondering what's up with this because we didn't get to see much of Sayers, or at least I didn't. But Craig, and I run to you on this because since Sayers and Willie Gallimore both played for the Bears, I saw definitely a kinship. As a matter of fact, there's footage. If you look at Willie Gallimore and Gale Sayers, if they didn't have numbers on their back, it would be hard to tell one from the other with the jukes that they made. But now, think about Kansas City making the appeal to their hometown star. Hey, you know what? Come to the AFL and be a Chief. And this is 65 now, so they're in the middle of whatever it is they're doing. You know, do you go with the status quo guy or do you go with the potentially wide-open offense? What do you think would have happened to Kansas City if they had drafted Sayers decides to come to the team and they're on the same squad as Otis Taylor, you know, and others making that team's nucleus?
In all likelihood, they'd have been better. And see, you're not only Gallimore, unfortunately, ended up in a car wreck. That's how he and another player died.
He died.
Over a stupid prank, really. Because one of the guys that played with him. At FAMU, used to work here at Fayetteville State.
Okay.
And to his dying day, Dr. Merck was mad at whoever came in and told him that they told him like they were like about to miss curfew.
Oh no!
And they had like a half hour or so more time than they said they had, but you know, and they hit a patch of ice on a road, but literally, had Gallimore lived, very likely, because the next offer came. By the time the next offer came, Gallimore, you know, was deceased. Because
right.
if that hadn't happened, in all likelihood, you know, the young man from Kansas probably would have been gone.
Yeah.
Now, and for those who don't know, Gallimore was from Florida A&M. And he was the one that invented the spike. Unfortunately, they try to say others did it first, but if Gallimore was doing it in 58 and the other one weren't doing it to 65, you know.
Yeah,
so,
that was Homer Jones. That's right.
Definitely.
That's right.
Mm-hmm. You know, it's called chronology. You understand chronology? You understand, okay, yeah. You can't maybe and but your way around that, that's probably come, you know, no, if he was doing it in 58 and I was doing it in 65, he was first. And see those are kinds of things that you run into when you're doing history because you know, you get people out there who have made their own version of certain facts, shall we say.
Yeah.
And they selectively hold on to certain facts or try to tell certain stories as fact until they reach a certain point. And when they reach that certain point, what do you have? If you listen to them, you have a lie being perpetuated as true. But unfortunately, if you don't listen to them and you look into it yourself, you start finding out, wow. You know, because I recently had a discussion with this about Jim Kearney. had played who's the quarterback
for Tennessee State, and then he was the defensive back for the Chiefs over the years.
And you know, and you had guys like him, Snake Riley, several other guys.
Mm-hmm.
They were good athletes, but the other thing that they forget is these guys were really smart. Because, had Snake Riley not chosen to play football, go ahead and play in the pros, he would have been the Rhodes Scholar.
Eventually became
a Rhodes Scholar from across on the other side of the track at Florida State, almost 50 years ago.
Yeah.
But see, when you have these selected scenarios and people who want you to lie about history instead of teaching history, this is what you end up with. And I just throw this out there since we're on that kind of a tear. You had these basketball aficionados who want to tell you, Dean Smith came up with the four corners and he just almost ruined basketball. Yeah, he didn't come up with the four corners. He was taught the four corners, and then he turned around and screwed it up.
Exactly. Well, Gary, I got to ask you.
Let me throw this in. And to think he didn't screw it up, this is why you have those clocks sitting in the corner of the floor.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. And now you got the shot clocks. That's how much he screwed it up.
That's how much he messed up. That's exactly right. They had to push it because of what he had done. And having said that, Gary, staying on the Sayers thing, the Chiefs, they were running what they called the offense of the 70s back in the day. They had small backs that they would hide behind that big-ass offensive line of theirs. Now, Sayers wasn't smallish, and he definitely was somebody who could get to a hole. And to quote him, give me 18 inches, that's all I need. Now, how would that have affected the Chiefs' offense if Sayers had become a Chief?
Well, I think they would have been a running offensive passing offense.
Mm-hmm.
That would have been a good Raider DJ. It would have been a good game if that happened.
Yeah, buddy, that would have been some good games.
The thing is, though, Mike, you got to remember also, Dale, and again, we looked up his numbers in 65. For the Bears as opposed to the running backs for the Chiefs that year. Sayers not only led them in rushing, but he also led them in receiving as well. He had the most receptions.
Sure did.
So, they might have won one more, but it might have been even more explosive because he was able to catch like about 30. He caught about 30, 40 balls. He had over 1,300 yards of offense. Now, on the surface, compared to now, that looks to be small.
Mm-hmm.
But back then, when you were still playing 12 games and what have you, and in the running instance, he was averaging 5 yards a pop, and he was damn near averaging double that with his catches. So. That's the thing that it might have, they might have run the ball more, but, it might have been a bit, let's put it this way, it probably would have been more balanced if nothing else, because when you've got somebody back there like that to offset, Curtis McClinton and the other sort of plodding running backs. Mack Lee Hunt wasn't a plotter per se, but
Mack Lee Hill, he wasn't, but
Sayers, they didn't call him the Kansas Comet for nothing.
That's true. He really was. Now this is where it gets interesting. We got Radio Reggie in the mix as well. Now Gale Sayers was a star. The league knew he was a star, but how well did they really desire to want to push black players? I mean, we knew we had Joe Brown, who we'll be talking about later, but we also had the fact that with what Sayers was doing, especially after that game against San Francisco, when he scores 6 touchdowns against them in almost every offensive mode. I mean, Gail Sayers destroyed San Francisco. And because of it, as rookie of the year, everybody knew this was somebody on the rise. But how do you promote somebody who you already see has, you know, talent and maybe has a little bit of charisma, too, from the couple of times he's been interviewed? You know, this would have brought a major dilemma in terms of, do we push this guy? Because we know when Joe Namath came in, they pushed him immediately. You know, he didn't even have to be good. He came in with all this hype, and he maybe fulfilled some of it. But Gale Sayers being a true star, how do you think the league would have had the issues with promoting him?
So are you talking about the AFL or the NFL?
Yeah, the AFL, because he's now in the other league.
Oh, I don't think the AFL.
AFL had no problem.
Yeah, I don't think it was any problem. Here's the thing. Namath was going to get more hype because of him being a white quarterback. But also, let's face
right.
it, even as great as the Chiefs were,
mm-hmm.
in New York, that whole East Coast bias thing sort of started, you know, with that. Now, granted, again, if you translate his numbers, because see, the thing about it is that rookie season that he had, that was one of
mm-hmm.
the best rookie seasons ever. And yeah, I mean, he scores damn near 100 points by himself. Between the touchdowns and what happened.
He had 22 touchdowns, and they were mixed up between runs.
And I think he had a handful more in the return yardage, because the 22 was
right.
just from the
exactly.
rushing, if I remember correctly.
Yeah.
So
mm-hmm. yeah.
The thing, so I mean. The AFL, I don't think the AFL wouldn't have been a problem. Now in the NFL, sadly, they would have, you know, he would have gotten the just another nigga principle. But what's also interesting is that you got to remember
mm-hmm.
that was also Jim Brown's last season. Jim Brown was MVP that
there
year.
There you go. Mm-hmm. That's right. Jim Brown was leaving. They told him when he went out to film 100 Rifles out in Hollywood that you need to bring your black ass back here. And he said, fuck you.
Actually, that was Dirty Dozen. 100 Rifles came later.
Oh, that's right. Excuse me. Dirty Dozen. Okay. So you didn't get the screw with Kel Welch yet. But, yes, Dirty Dozen was a good flick. And Reggie, what do you think would have happened if Jim Brown had decided to come back to the NFL and just play?
Gentlemen, happy holidays. The way things were going with the way blacks were being treated back then, I wouldn't be surprised if he might have got hurt. I mean, he went on top of his career, but let's be honest. You look at how the Washington football team, then the Redskins owner, Preston Marshall,
mm-hmm.
said, if I'm going to pick
yep.
the nigga that we on my team, I'm going to get the nigga
that's
I
right.
want. And we know
yeah,
how
right.
that went. And just a follow-up
mm-hmm.
to it. What year are we talking? 1960 what? When Jim Brown walked in?
1965. They won the division.
Okay.
They won the division that year and lost in the championship to the Packers.
So just be honest about this. We just had 3 bastards. Thank God, not changing the subject. 3 bastards convicted for a homicide
yeah.
and a lynching
mm-hmm.
in 2021. 1965,
right.
they weren't even keeping records of how many black folks they were lynching down the South. So all I'm saying
right.
is that for Jim Brown and Kareem Abdul-Jabbar and all those great activists with Muhammad Ali to stand in front of that picture to them was not only disobedient, but it was frightening. And for Jim Brown to be a part of that movement, like the man said, Malcolm, that's too much power for a nigga to have.
Well, it's funny, you know, you got to remember, Malcolm was killed just a year before.
Yeah.
He was killed in 65.
The
What year did Johnson sign the civil rights act?
Malcolm was killed in February. Malcolm was killed in February, if I remember correctly.
Martin was killed in 68. Malcolm was killed in 65.
Okay,
I thought it was 64, Mike.
No, it's 65.
It was 65.
Oh,
okay. We lived about four blocks away from the Audubon Ballroom when it happened. And when we ran up there to see what had happened, they were literally dragging that gurney across the boulevard where Audubon Avenue, St. Nicholas Avenue, and Broadway intersect.
Right. So, Professor, being a great historian, help me understand something. The way the country was back then and the notoriety Mr. Brown was having, what do you think the government would have done to him?
Oh, they had a way of dealing with Negroes like that. And it was not always pleasant or, you know, it's like we did in a lot of small towns. We had a gentleman here who was, I'll call him a local hero back in the day.
Mm-hmm.
And he was one of those who was told after they put him in the back seat of the vehicle, say, I wasn't there. I had nothing to do with it. I wasn't even in town. And the cops said, we don't care what you say or where you were and all that kind of stuff. We're going to find 2-3 white guys who said they saw you and you're going to be in front of a white judge, white DA, white defense attorney, and an all-white jury.
You don't
stand a chance. And homeboy gets out of jail 32 or 36 years later.
Mm-hmm.
After they discovered all the fabrication and all that other kind of stuff that went on, you know, with his situation. You know, and to put a literary premise behind this, you know, have you all ever looked at the end of To Kill a Mockingbird?
Yes.
And understand what went on there?
Yeah.
Because this gentleman who couldn't run got convicted of chasing down this white girl, and he could barely walk.
That's right.
He had one somewhat good leg and a really bad leg, but he was convicted. And on the way to prison, the deputy says he tried to get away. I let him out in order to protect the leak, and he tried to get away. Now, this same guy who couldn't run when they caught him was tried and convicted of chasing down this white girl.
Mm-hmm.
And then as he was going, being sent off to prison by a local deputy, which he should not have been, the way they handled these kind of things back then, somehow or another, He was trying to run away from the deputy, and he gets shot in the back.
Not that going on.
And see, it's hard to tell some folks, and especially some white folk. This is why we paranoid.
Yep. Ain't no lie about that.
Like I said, both my nieces are confirmed to me because. They were very well educated. Although one of them went to Duke, one of them went to Prairie View. They confirmed to me that, hey, ain't no way that black folks, no matter what your past in life has been, there's almost no way that you cannot be experiencing some level of PTSD because just by living in the United States of America.
That's right. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I get right about that. I've lived abroad, and I can tell you there's definitely some meat in that sandwich, my brother. But to carry on with this what-if scenario, we go from Gelsayers to Jim Brown. You know, Jim Brown had a clear lead. He was obviously the best player in the league. And as Tony and I found out, he was one of the top wage earners. And back then, he was making, what, $60,000, Tony? You know, so
$60,000
in $1965.
And the average, mind you, the average salary, we looked it up as well, the average salary in 1965 was about $35,000-$40,000. So, you know, it wasn't, you know, again, needless to say, this was pre, this was pre, you know, arbitration and pre NFLPA
yep.
sort of thing. Although that iconic picture that we always talk about with Brown, Ali, Kareem, a bunch of other prominent athletes, black athletes at the time, you know, Lynn Ford, Bobby Mitchell, Bill
yep.
Russell as well. I think in many ways that might have been somewhat of the start of the Players Associations, not just for football but for all sports, because that was the one
right.
thing that that was the one thing that Brown did. That was the thing that they hated more so about Brown than what he did on the field, was the fact that
mm-hmm.
you know, he was talking about these guys being set up for
yeah.
at the end of their careers, because see
yeah.
To Brown's credit, he had those other options of doing movies. Let's face it. Unless you were a Brown or Willie Davis or God, who else I could think of maybe back in that time? Maybe somebody like, say, maybe a Jim Marshall, possibly, whatever. But let's face it. The majority
yeah.
of players during that period of time, especially the black players, did
yep.
not have that backup, you know, did not have
That's
that
true.
Backup. And they were ignorant to that backup. You know, we hear,
mm-hmm.
we always hear stories about, you know, the old Baltimore Colts, about how they had to take jobs in town during the
mm-hmm.
off season because, I mean, they made okay money, but they weren't making the kind of money. Now we tried to speculate who, you know, if Brown was making, say, 65, of 60, 65, you got to figure guys back in the day, like, say, Bart Starr and
Frank Gifford
were probably making maybe 65 or 70 or
mm-hmm.
what have you. I don't think, sadly, you know, Jim Brown may have been the greatest player in the game, but he probably was not being paid as the greatest player in the game.
Exactly.
And that's one reason why he was able to, I mean, he probably made more money in his first movie more money from the Dirty Dozen than he did possibly during his entire career in Cleveland.
That's true. I think that's
yeah.
actually true, especially
so,
if his
so,
contract
so,
if his contract
so
included residuals, you make a serious cash.
Sure.
So
sure.
in essence what you were talking about is he was not only an outstanding football player, but he was also an outstanding businessman. Because
oh,
if you know, if you follow
mm-hmm.
Willie Davis, you know, Willie Davis'
mm-hmm.
best year, he had, I think he made $93,000 in Super Bowl money.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. And that came to 100 and something back then. And, you know, Willie, the thing is, you know, remember when Willie Davis got cut the first two
mm-hmm.
or three times out of Chicago, he went to grad school.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And it was a very rational situation. He said, well, I didn't have a lot of money, but, you know, when he was down in Gremlin, he had next to nothing. So he was
yeah.
getting a little money. He worked whatever jobs he worked. But
mm-hmm.
then from there, while he was still trying to make football teams, and before he was discovered by Green Bay, homeboy would go into graduate school. So by the time he got to Green Bay, actually he'd almost finished his MBA.
Mm-hmm. 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 And ironically, forgive me. Willie was in that picture. So now, what was it? I know it was like Coca-Cola, and he owned radio stations and what have you. He was you know, he was, again, he and Jim Brown were probably one of the few players who could not. Now, Willie wound up retiring about 4 years later in 1969. And,
right.
you know, he was able to basically, you know, make the transition because, you know, he had, you know, like I first said, got his degree.
People
forget. And
Tony, Willie Davis was part of that group that tried to buy Memphis an expansion team.
Exactly.
You know, they didn't get the, their bid wasn't accepted, probably because he had not enough green to hide his black. But Willie Davis had it down financially. He was loaded.
You could say Willie Davis left because you remember he was still he was numerically young and healthy,
mm-hmm.
but realistically,
yeah, he wasn't returning, was he? He was in his early 30s.
Remember, though, playing in NFL probably was costing him money.
He had made contact. He was there in Green Bay,
Milwaukee, right down the road, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah.
And he had made contact because remember he had beer distributorships. He called them because I heard him speak up at Carolina. He was the one that made the comment about Michael Jordan, him being worth more than Michael Jordan. And he said, mm-hmm. well, and they kept him, well, you know, Michael Jordan made that. He said that, hey, Michael Jordan is employee. He's at the whim of the team he's playing for, the league, mm-hmm. et cetera, et cetera. He said, If I bought the team, basically I would own Michael. And if you mm-hmm. should have seen, you know, and see the funny thing was y'all should have seen the look on some of the white folks' face when they said, What do you mean you would have mm-hmm. owned Michael Jordan? And he said, hey, Michael is just another guy who plays basketball. He don't mm-hmm. own nothing. I owned, at that time, I think the limit was like 6 or 8 radio mm-hmm. stations. I owned that from I think, St. Louis all the way to mm-hmm. West Coast, down to check, you know, the one in Louisiana, you know, that kind mm-hmm. of stuff. I owned whatever the limit for radio station was at the time. He owned all of that. He owned beer distributorships in about 20 major areas. So... And then he got into his thing about real estate. He said, I got all these things making money for me. These people, you know, he said, if I still had the sign checks, I'd sign probably 1,000 checks plus a day. Easy.
Hmm.
And that's just management checks. And he went on to explain, you know, how he had come from a guy who, for whatever reason, kept getting cut the first two years he was – he was in trying to make the league.
He actually played for Cleveland.
Cleveland. Let me be nice. Cleveland had problems, and he still got them now. So what can I say?
Hey professor, okay. I'm gonna throw some at you. Okay, remember when the Clippers were up for sale? And everybody was thinking about, oh, man, Magic Johnson, Oprah, they're going to get together and make big money. And when the bids went out, they got smashed. This little nerd from California came in there with damn near $1 billion more than what they even bid it. Now, from a psychological point of view, how devastating is that to black folks when they see this nerd come in? Make a bid that's better than Magic Johnson, Oprah Winfrey. How devastating is that?
Well, it shouldn't be that devastating because you have to realize that income is not necessarily wealth. Wealth mm-hmm. is how much money you got making money for you, and they have not been out there long enough and gotten big mm-hmm. enough to do those kinds of things because. Let's go back to the little nerds. Remember, about half the people are billionaires. have been, you know, they didn't finish college. Matter of fact, about half of them got kicked out of college.
Mm-hmm.
So they, you know, and see, you got, we look too much at what I would call normal people that become billionaires, multimillionaires, billionaires. You know, a lot of those people are not quote unquote normal. Joe Dudley, who built Dudley Products from a bunch of bottles in his stove in his kitchen into a multimillion-dollar business, at one point was declared LD. Okay, when he was 12 years old, they told him, you know, his parents told that boy he will never amount to nothing. Well, you know, and that's one Aggie I can vouch for. And he went on to ENT, got his degree, went to work, you know, and he studied under Mr. Fuller of Fuller Products out in Chicago. He learned how to sell. He learned how to put things together. And he's still making music, although his business has shrunk.
So that's the Fuller Brush Man, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah. Fuller Brush Man. Who was an eighth grade graduate?
Hmm.
And at his height, until they discovered that a black man owned Fuller Products down in the Deep South, he was sending white guys down there to sell for him, and one of them finally spilled the beans on him.
Yep. Because,
you know,
it's matter of fact, Reg, you know the Chris Rock thing when he says he's rich and white folks are rich. That's the difference. Because see, first of all, you know, forgive me, I don't think Oprah's funky ass whatever would have gotten together with Magic Johnson in regards to that. But that's another 2-hour story in and of itself. But the thing is also is that there's wealth, there's being woodway, there's rich, and then there's wealth. Now, the guy for the Clippers, remember, they were part of, you know, most of his money was done through the dot com. And if I remember correctly, he may have been one of the guys that was part of the original gang, or either the part of the original gang or the later gang under Microsoft, when Microsoft, you know, finally hit big. So, you know, there's a difference between, you know, wealth and liquid wealth. And see, that's the thing, you know. Dick, see, the thing is, the Clippers are finally gonna get their own arena. They're gonna leave the Staples Center, which they never probably should have came to in the first place. But I get it. Now that the owner, you know, now they have, you know, made the brand so much for themselves. Now that they have the cachet to make their own, you know, to have their own building now, as opposed to being the little bastard child at the Staples Center.
Into the oven we go. I'm still cooking while we're doing all this, y'all. So can't let Thanksgiving get in the way of good discussion. But
make sure them beans are okay, Mike. Make sure them burn them beans, man.
I gotta ask the obligatory Thanksgiving question: who made the potato salad?
Oh Lord.
Two questions always usually start an argument on Thanksgiving Day. First,
one,
are you pregnant? And
or two,
who made the potato salad?
That's right. That's right. As a matter of fact, I think the potato salad question was
not necessarily in that order. Not necessarily in
that order,
by the way.
Oh, hell yeah. No. I mean, like, potato salad seemingly is universal. So when we hear somebody altering a recipe, it's not usually a good thing. Now, I've heard all kinds of strange shit with potato salad. But now that y'all went there, What's the most unusual thing somebody put in potato salad that they try to tell you it was authentic? Like they made it.
Raisins.
Raisins? Oh, Lord.
Raisins.
Hey, as the Black Panther said, the great ancestor on Saturday Night Live, oh, no. She made raisins.
No. Yeah, yeah,
she cannot do it. Oh, no.
Hell no.
Hey, but guys, I was at church one time last year. Who made the potato salad? And this old lady cussed me out in church.
Listen, I've seen someone lambaste somebody for potato salad. Nothing personal, Landlin. But yeah, it wasn't raisins. One person used celery seed and had a different taste to it and stuff like that. And another one used egg and cheese. Egg and cheese.
Oh, God.
You know, like the egg wasn't enough, but cheese too. Oh, Lord. Mm. Oh, there's that too. And then, of course, there's German potato salad, which is made wholly different. And, well, as far as turkey on Thanksgiving is concerned, I know one person that didn't like it is my youngest daughter, Deborah. So I had to make her something that was very un-turkey. So I made her a shepherd's pie, and she loved it, and that's what she would eat. And then it turned out to be shepherd's pie or lasagna for her.
Mm-hmm.
So in that vein, gentlemen, other than Twinkie, what would you have on your Thanksgiving table?
I know tomorrow, ribs, but to me, that's not weird.
Mm. Well, I love ribs. That sounds like a good idea,
yeah,
actually.
Collard greens
are traditional. Gary, this is an important question. What does she cook her collard greens in?
Ham hock, turkey wing, turkey leg.
Oh, yeah, yeah. But don't be using nobody's ass. I don't care how much flavor there might be in there. I don't want no ass in my pot or on my plate.
So smoked pork butt is out for tomorrow. Then,
smoked
right?
ass? No, I don't want no smoke. No. Like, smoking, but I digress.
Now, what do we all say for pig's feet for Thanksgiving?
Trotters?
No,
pig feet are
standalone. You don't put them in nothing.
Oh, okay.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Can it be included?
Y'all must all be from the city. Y'all be mixing up the crazy stuff.
I just want Thanksgiving.
Whatever's in front of me that I can recognize and actually taste pretty good. I am all opportunity eater.
Do you barbecue your trotters?
No.
Okay.
You boil them. Then you marinate them in vinegar, and maybe. And some people throw a little like some kind of spice on them, but you know that's
like
individual.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, you can spice them up, by themselves, but what you want to do is get the you boil them in just water and maybe some like onion or something like that.
Mm-hmm. All right, that's working.
And guys,
for
those people who barbecue again, that's a separate thing.
Yeah.
Some people grill them, but that's a separate thing.
Mm-hmm.
But it's all still part of that Thanksgiving rotation, though. Am I correct?
That's exactly
for
right.
Some people. Unfortunately, in our family, we're maturing now, And we have a situation called we fat. We're above the legal limit weight wise. Plus, we have a lot of hypertension, and different ones are finally trying to eat properly and all those kind of things.
Mm-hmm.
So most of us have pretty well taken pork off the table. To a great degree.
Oh no, you're not going vegan on us, are you?
Oh hell no.
Very few
vegetarians, and see, most vegetarians in my family have this. This is how they describe being a vegetarian. They only eat animals that eat vegetables. Okay. Beyond that, they don't.
But see, that's a cop out because pretty much
on the vegan side. My doctor's husband is actually a vegan, and when he explained what that was, I don't think so.
He was never invited back to the cookout, was he?
But that's a bring your own food.
That sounds like a no. That little pregnant pause lets me know that's a no.
Well, I have to be nice to him. He, you know, his wife is my doctor.
And he's
a Steeler fan, which I can't understand.
Oh,
that.
See, there you go.
I watched the game Sunday night, and I could not. Who is it? Bobby Womack. He said that song. I can understand it.
That's right. Well. This brings us to another Thanksgiving theme, and the fact that we will be cooking and baking and marinating and doing whatever, and the Detroit putty tats will be getting their ass whipped.
That is the
Thanksgiving tradition. How did Detroit get so bad so soon?
It's not like there's been a team where we had a Detroit team.
They may have a shot tomorrow because your favorite redhead and his Andy Dalton is going to be under center tomorrow because Mr. Fields is hurt. They've got a shot.
Hey, T-Mac, Jason Garrett on line two.
Like I said, America's favorite. Not America's least favorite clapping white man in the world. But
all right.
Yeah,
see,
yeah,
that brings us to another what if. What if Patrick Farrar was there to say that there's no way in hell that Andy Dalton should start for the Chicago Bears against the Putty Tats tomorrow afternoon? Patrick, are you there?
Live and living color, fellas. What it ain't.
What up, Baker Mayfield? How that knee doing, Baker?
Another commercial?
Another commercial. Got that right. About winning, though.
But Patrick, you've been in the front office. I mean, we see Detroit every year. Everybody know they're going to get their ass whipped on Thanksgiving. So everybody's just going on ahead and cooking the food and whatnot, playing music or whatever the hell. How did Detroit get so bad for so long? I mean, you're in the front office like that. How do you see that development? How does it continue?
Well, I think the little I know about Detroit, I knew some people in Detroit years ago, but that's 10 years ago. You know, there's sometimes a folk get locked into in the fantasy. I mean, when they had, what's his name, a couple years ago? What's this guy's name? Played with the Raiders and with Penn State. When he had it was
Matt Millen.
Cheers.
They made him GM.
The coffin was open, but he put the nails in the coffin with some of the selections he had. And then also, when I think the situation that they have there, a lot of things have been relegated to what makes the owner happy rather than what makes the team win.
Mm-hmm.
And I can tell you now, I don't care what it is, if ownership and reality of team building aren't the same, you will have problems. And exemplifies with Detroit Lions right there, because first of all, Campbell never should have been the coach in the first place. I mean, that's number one. But they need to get somebody.
Patrick, that's part of the problem. They wanted to get him on the cheap. That was the whole deal, because probably plus also we got to remember they had a coach. Two coaches ago.
Your Kappa brother. Yeah, your Kappa brother.
But we'd rather have a losing record with Lou Albano and Mr. Campbell as opposed to a winning record with the brother.
Mm-hmm. Right. No, I'm 100%. I mean, it's the same thing. If Bears is a reflection, but amplified for me, we're right here in New York with the Jets. The Jets is always thinking about marketing rather than about winning, and that's a big part of the problem.
They do just enough to satisfy, Fire Marshal Bill, and a few other half drunk fans that show up to the game, and they don't realize that they've been, dare I say it, they've been bamboozled, run amuck, led astray.
Led astray. Oh, my brother, I stand again.
Patrick, what was the straw that Jason Garrett had to be sacrificial last? Because they got more problems than Jason Garrett.
The thing with the Giants, Lord have mercy. Jason Garrett basically was brought in to help out Joe Judge, because Joe Judge never had any coaching experience. It was to help him out. But obviously,
that's true.
As you can tell by the offense, obviously, you can see by the offense had no structure to where it was beginning to illuminate an offense that was going to be successful. And, here's another part of that. You got to know who Jason Garrett is and who Jason Garrett's family is connected to for years. Garrett's father was such a great coach and a football person. If Jared got needed a job, they won't give him a job. I mean, the cover up was, well, they need somebody experienced besides a coach that hadn't coached before. But Jason Garrett's the combination between the Mara family and Jason Garrett's father, I mean, I've seen Jason Garrett's father. He died a couple of years ago. But he's around that team all the time, even though he's coaching other places. Mm-hmm. So it was an automatic tie-in, but it wasn't helping him win. And if you ran an offense long enough, I'm going, wait a minute, this looks like the same thing that they had down in Dallas that ain't working. And maybe the players could amplify. No, it doesn't work that well.
No shit. Pat, did you bring up a good idea? Because we've been talking earlier about what-if scenarios regarding players and other things. And just as we were talking earlier about Gale Sayers and what he would have been like had he been a Kansas City Chief as opposed to a Chicago Bear, I got to ask you, what would life have been like for Joe Namath if he had gone to the St. Louis Cardinals, since they were the traditional league, rather than become Broadway Joe? Would Namath have gotten as far as the St. Louis Cardinal, in your opinion?
I don't know, quite frankly. But New York helped out Joe Namath in terms of his ability. Now, even though Joe's record as a Hall of Famer is more losses than wins, but Joe's Joe's ability and Joe's ability to be able to light a defense up because,
yep.
you know, Joe, people don't understand. Despite Joe's leg, Joe could throw a ball. That
yeah, he could.
And you know something? Mm-hmm. Here's how I know a Joe could play. I saw Joe make a play. I forgot what game it was. But make a long story short, you know, when the game was over, the defense of the team that we just played came and shook his hand.
Monday night game against the Raiders. I remember, yeah, Monday night game against the Raiders.
Oh, no, women.
Madden even said that was the one time after a game that he won, he went over into the other locker room and shook the, shook
mm-hmm.
hands with the, wow. with the starting quarterback.
Okay. Because Joe could toss it. Make no mistake.
He definitely could toss it, no question.
Mm-hmm.
He could toss. So with that in mind, that player for a game worked better in New York and the rest is history. Could you have been successful in St. Louis? Maybe some more
yeah.
weapons. But mm-hmm. New York really helped him out.
Wow.
Well, in addition, being in New York where you had the giant, the media giants from
yeah.
TV and newspapers, magazines, that kind of stuff, that didn't hurt Joe either. And you had
mm-hmm.
ownership who was willing to ride that wave.
Yep.
Because remember, in college, Joe was not necessarily a passing quarterback.
He was a running quarterback.
No, he wasn't. Right.
Yes.
So now, you know, and it was, Bear Bryant used what I call the Bill Hayes early philosophy on passing. You pass
mm-hmm.
into the end zone or out of it. In middle of the field,
yep.
you run the ball. And that's,
mm-hmm.
with the wishbone back then,
yep.
The way that Bear Bryant ran it, usually in the first two or three times with the ball, you're going to end up until they start running into black players, they could cut you down when it came to receivers
mm-hmm.
and all those white boys that were playing defensive back.
Mm-hmm.
They could contain you. Well, once they started counting black players and the white and
mm-hmm.
the black guys start running, you know. No, let's not call anybody from California's name. Lynn Swan. when he went deep a couple of times, and then you had
mm-hmm.
Sam Bangle deep a couple of times. He started going out there. But remember, Bear Bryant, to his credit, was one. Well, he learned from one of the best, and that was Jake
mm-hmm.
Gaither. He was a hell of a recruiter.
Yeah. Yeah.
And you know, like he would tell, like he told Bear Bryant. I mean, Gaither told Bear Bryant, "Ain't nobody that's any good leaving Florida unless I say so." So
there you go.
So
I like that.
Think about it. Where were most of the coaches in the high schools? A large portion of them in Alabama, Mississippi, came from
mm-hmm.
Bear Bryant.
Yeah.
After the first 3 or 4 years in Alabama, hey, he had to pick of the litter, just like
mm-hmm.
Coach Dr. Bell told used to tell Jake, you know, we go after the best of Florida, then we go to Ohio,
mm-hmm.
get some linemen, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Yeah, and then we go out and beat the hell out of whoever we play. Well,
uh-huh,
that's what they
uh-huh.
do.
Okay, that sounds right.
Uh-huh.
And so, remember, Joe Namath didn't know where Alabama was.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, that's how that egg got cracked, but still.
I'm Pennsylvania, at that time, Alabama was recruiting up in this area.
Yes,
there was a guy named a guy named Ed Tuck out of Harris, New Jersey. He was a fullback, but weighed not this fullback. He weighed 270 pounds.
Oh,
I believe
that.
Fullback.
I believe that.
270 pounds. Mm-hmm. You know, because you know, at that time they were playing in between the hash. All right. So you know, Ed Tuck scored about 22. I said, but Bear Bryant came and got him and made that boy out of fullback about 60 pounds lighter from a lineman to a fullback. And the boy went on and made SEC comments. But he didn't mind coming up here. Now, in case of Joe Namath, now, same with Joe. Joe got, there was that, Alabama has that name to come up here.
Oh,
but,
exactly.
And, but he wouldn't get no brothers. But Joe did, Alabama came up north.
But you know, you have to understand too, and this is, you know, just like we say when we, about these guys who don't want to get their shots, they will, you know, I won't play in this state, you know, what the rules of the state. Well, when you go to the rules of the state, even here in North Carolina, you could go to Duke back in the day. You just couldn't stay on campus because according to North Carolina law, you couldn't do that. Well, remember, 1965, Alcorn had like a 28-20, like they had a winning, they had a season like 26-2, something like that. They couldn't go to the NAIA tournament because there was a possibility of them playing against black players. The University of Mississippi had to slip their team out of the state on private planes to go and play in what we call March Madness now. I mean, when Southern Cal came out to Tuscaloosa. It was 1970, 71, whatever it was. The laws on the book said Negroes still could not. They had a one or two girls that, I mean, you know, they'd gone through that little situation of integrating University of Alabama.
Wonder why they playing those sports though.
matter of fact, one of the things that got Joe in trouble those early years in Alabama was his affinity for some brown sugar, and I'm not talking about the confectioners.
No, that's right. You know what I mean,
isn't there a certain irony to the fact that not only did Joe know where black girls were, a lot of his teammates who were black girls.
Yeah.
You know, remember the old In the Heat of the Night when Carol O'Connor there will always be white folks who know people in the bottom.
That's a given.
That's right.
Now, do we know if Joe made one of them calls back to Beaver Falls saying, "Hey, Sonya, I'm not coming back home no more. See ya."
I tell you what, he wasn't making any pantyhose commercials either.
And also, you got to realize one of Joe's tightest friends was some brothers.
That's right.
I know that because I've had one of the last interviews that he ever did done so far. Hopefully, he's feeling better. Matt Snell, he and Matt Snell were close at one time, and
until the Jets did him dirty.
Just dirty. That was big time. That's one day I'll talk about that. But Joe had no problem hanging around brothers until they got hooked up with the boys, the Sons of Italy. What they wanted to do, and they had to kind of calm down a little bit.
That Bachelor 3 madness, yes. But now that you brought that up, Patrick, will you bring us to our last what if of the night? Now, we know gambling is as American as apple pie, especially if you've been on the apple. But
there'd be no NFL without gambling.
Time,
Exactly. So what would happen? What if there were no restrictions on gambling and players were able to take matters into their own hands literally by deciding they could beat the odds by being their own orchestrator? You know, the scandal, the so-called scandal that would have happened in 1950 with collegiate basketball never would have made the headlines. It would have been, all right,
well,
who wins, who loses, take your cut, and goodbye.
Well, it happened with Paul Horning
and Alex Karras.
Mm-hmm. I mean, that was an example of to legitimize the game. Now, you know, folks,
yes,
well, betting all day
yeah,
long.
Exactly.
How it would have grown, I don't know. I do know that there was a moral clause and restricted certain things that could affect the game. They
right.
wanted to leak, tell you, we knew they were gambling, but they wanted to look like it wasn't gambling. But we knew there was. Again, guys, Maris family brought the Giants on a $600 bet in the 1930s. That's how the New York Giants got brought.
Wow.
So don't tell me
mm-hmm.
they know how.
Come on.
They know about gambling. They know about
well,
it's
as,
always been
as Jimmy Durante's pet cat would say, and furthermore, you had the incident. We had the incident with Art Schleister's, well, not his pet cat, but with Art Schleister.
Oh, please.
Art, was the,
mm-hmm.
Art had the gambling
oh,
bug
please.
Big time. The gambling bug was biting him all in his ass. But in this world where he can bet, now he becomes a target because you know somebody will tell Art, you know what, we're playing that game against Michigan, and 250 grand, you throw the game, ain't no thing. Now, of course, if you live in the area and you know of the rivalry, maybe he does, maybe he doesn't, Patrick. But
no.
Mike.
I would like to think that the Columbus version of Jimmy the Finger and of course his wife Lady Fingers would come up to Art at some point and be like, "I wish you would, because you'll lose more than a finger if you allow." Can I have your permission to say it, Patrick? That team up north to come there and win this game.
I was there during the whole period.
Yes.
I'm not going to go to the litany of things that happened, but I will say
okay.
this. When they were recruiting him, they knew he had a problem
mm-hmm.
in high school.
Really?
They
oh,
knew it.
Wow.
And again, I mentioned a long time ago, my ex-wife
mm-hmm.
was a news anchor at the time on Channel 6, and she did a major story on him.
Uh-huh.
And
okay.
I told about 30-30, it was 100-100 information she had. But when she won to she went and got all sources together, and she talked
mm-hmm.
to me about certain things that, you know, I would never tell that she found out.
Mm-hmm.
She says, "Honey, I'm going
wow.
to sit this through." I said, and I was trying to tell her, I said, "See that? Yeah, I don't know if we're going to get this out." He said, "I got this."
I know that's right.
She got one piece of information. All you need to know was when Earl Brewis claimed that he didn't know he was gambling. Well,
mm-hmm.
she got information from pitchers and information from police that Earl Brewis liked the tracks. Well, Earl Brewis liked the tracks, bet on the horse, and guess who was sitting
Damn.
Next to him? It wasn't his mama.
Yeah,
it was him.
Mrs. Linder.
So basically what happened when she won put the story to the station, they said, that's nice, but we'll never do it.
Oh,
that's
shit.
That's how bad it was.
Well, speaking about never do, that means Pete Rose would have been absolved because his behavior would have been considered normal.
Lord, have
mercy. And he'd be in the Hall of Fame.
Wait, tell you. Pete Rose was betting how many cows would pee on the farm out in Ohio, man.
Yeah.
I tell him he's betting.
Mm-hmm.
They know about it. You know,
I believe that.
Again, one of the things I like about the Philly Cat now, let's be honest, we know what's betting, and let's make money on it. You know, stop this
yeah.
all clause nonsense. That's like marijuana.
Exactly.
You know,
mm-hmm.
you know, come on, you don't know.
How many of your brothers and sisters in jail for the rest of their life over selling weed?
You go.
But
come on
now,
come on.
White boys coming up and discussed. Matter of fact, just about less than a mile from Fayetteville State University, there's what we used to call a head shop. There's one of those facilities, one of those legal facilities that sells hemp. Matter of fact, there's one in each direction because there's one on the edge of downtown just over from the transit center. Used to be, you know, like they say, it used to be a drugstore. Now it's really a drugstore.
One of the things that if you ever get a chance to view, and I'm matter of fact, I've got through half of it. PBS had Ken Burns do the piece on prohibition.
Okay.
If you understand prohibition, it's beautifully detailed what they did during the history of how alcohol in this country and how it evolved. It mirrors marijuana like night and freaking day. But the trick about it is Anslinger, the guy that Hoover put in charge in terms of killing marijuana, made the decision make marijuana illegal because marijuana was used around particularly artists, and artists were usually jazz musicians, and jazz musicians had a fluidity among all kind of people, and it got bad when the musicians started having the white women around, and that's when it all started. It became illegal.
That's right.
It's beautifully right. Together. So in marijuana, but the point is, gambling is nothing but a reflection of this society, man. Come on. That's what I'm glad to just legalize it and let people make money, get some tax money off of it, and keep moving.
Nobody says shit in thoroughbred racing when an owner bets on his horse.
Mercy.
The groom, the trainer, everybody and their mama bet on the horse. That motherfucker wins. Everybody gets paid. Everybody's happy. And the world moves on. You know?
Don't have to pee after the race.
Thank you.
Exactly.
There you go, Fred. 100%. Who's putting the needle in the horse's butt? Come on, stop.
That's right. But remember, horse racing would have been legitimized a long time ago if it wasn't for those cats trying that shit at the Breeders' Cup. If you remember one Breeders' Cup, they posted some of the results of the races so that it rigged one ticket to win the Pit Six, which was ridiculous money at the time, something like $1.6 million or something like that. But then somebody got greedy, and they ran it so that another one would be registered as a winner. And as soon as they saw two, they decided to check, and that's when they found out that the system had been hacked. So we know cheating is something that's going to always be there, and we know betting is something that's going to always be there. But betting responsibly, like they used to say at OTB, bet with your head not over it. I mean, you hit it right on the head, but in an atmosphere where gambling is legal now, anything can happen. Yeah, how many games can we honestly say we've seen where we know big money was on the game because of the result? That game between the Sacramento Kings and the Lakers in the playoffs, we knew somebody was betting money on that shit. You know, we know that. You know, the game between Roethlisberger and the Pittsburgh Steelers and the Seattle Seahawks, where Ben Roethlisberger still ain't scored. As a matter of fact, hello, 911, what's your emergency? That motherfucker's stealing. He don't care about he lost that goal line. See, shit like that.
Yeah.
We know that changed everything. We know that there was something going on that was funky. And of course, Marshawn Lynch, we don't even have to say no more. You know? My youngest daughter don't know nothing about football except that I watch it too much, and she said, how come they're not giving 24 the ball? I rest my case.
And Professor Vinny can verify this. Every single play in the National Football League, you go owning every single play.
Mm-hmm.
They pick and choose which one they're gonna do.
Mm-hmm. That's true. You're right about
and
that.
And particularly against Tom Brady.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Well, if you go, you know, gambling is so bad, and this whole thing about image and imagery. We go back a few years to when Butler was playing Duke.
Watch
the trail official. If that ball had gone in, he was ready to blow the whistle and travel.
And see,
the reason that system that they use when they blow the whistle, the clock stops.
Mm-hmm.
That system was tested out in the CIAA about 10-12 years ago. And matter of fact, the young man who one of the inventors of that system used to be an official in the CIAA. So it's good that his brother invented that system. Now they roll in it. But it's not just about calling holding on every play. All the plays, the plays that are called as far as officiating is all subjective. Is it reviewable or unreviewable?
And
that's what they call.
And Fred, what you're saying, listen to what you're saying, Fred, who was called against at what time?
Right. Yeah, that's right.
Remember a few years ago there was this situation where there was this pass interference of somebody with one team going into the end zone. On triangling of the play, you had the official behind it, in front of it, and to the side. Not one blew the whistle.
Yeah.
And people who don't even know football were saying, damn, that looked like interference.
There's another aspect of this that's been happening too much too often lately, and that's seeing roughing the passer calls.
I've seen some bullshit.
And we know this is a physical game, and you ain't supposed to beat somebody over the head with an axe. But come on. Some of these calls have been just ridiculous.
Mike, I got one greater than that, Mike. It happened Sunday.
Okay.
Remember in the Kansas City game, the guy points at the receiver when defensive back when he's going to end zone?
Yes.
I'm going, what? Somebody
that's
taunting. What?
That taunt call is also bullshit. Yes.
Okay. In addendum to that, listen to what the talking heads have to say when these situations arise. They are full of it, and they're so ready to critique the play as it was called by the official. It's almost as if they knew that was what was fixing to happen.
Come on.
That's just my personal assumption of it. And I said, how are you going to know to address this in this kind of detail
based on
the fact that it just happened to happen as it's supposed, it's the circumstances of the game. No, it's not the circumstance of the game. It's the circumstance as it's being played out based on what was supposed to happen. Because remember a few years ago, this terminology came out that says so-and-so scripts the first 25 plays of the game.
Yes, they do. Yeah. All the time.
That's right.
Well, is it just me or does it seem as if certain teams, wink, wink, i.e. NFL, scripts the first 25 plays of the game? Because there's too many. Remember, who was it? Richard Pryor used to use the term coincidentitis.
Yeah.
Somebody used to use that term. And it's a play on the word coincidence. And, as we like to say, you know, certain things just don't happen that way.
Hey, Fred,
there's a rhyme and reason to all this stuff.
Fred, you know, I want to add to that, Fred, and you guys, it always happens. When they have the referees now intertwined with the broadcast to legitimize what calls they make, 99% of the time, the guy that's in the booth always agrees with the guy calling the field. I mean, come on. And some things are just so egregious, that has to be a call. Really?
Yeah. Well, not you know, not just that. Listen, again, go back to the jargon that's used, you know, throughout the game. Because I saw a pass Sunday night by a quarterback who shall remain nameless. That was about 10 feet. That was about 10 feet over this guy, 10 feet above his head.
Mm-hmm.
Only to hear from the talking head, he should have caught that. Now, it landed behind, at 10 feet above his head at the position where he was on the field, which was close to the sideline, and the ball landed behind the players, not hitting none of them. But it was a perfect throw. He just didn't catch it. I think the Yahoo who was making that call has been one of the biggest hits on the butt of color commentating in the history of the game in a long, long, long time. But, you know, because he's white, I don't think we'll ever get rid of him because he's jacked up from the neck up anyway. And plus, he used to play for the Bengals. So, it means, anyway, let me not get into that.
Bengals.
Lamar Jackson, a couple of weeks ago, made a bullet pass in the middle, right? The guy in his chest, right? The strong hand said, oh, that ball is too hard. Really?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, we hear that kind of nonsense. But if they had been John Elway throwing it, they'd have said, what a rifle John Elway has.
And Mike, very quickly, talking about selective hits on in refereeing, Tyrone Taylor got hit so hard that I ducked when he got hit twice Sunday.
They've been beating
I'm
that
going,
brother like a runaway slave
wait
ever
a minute.
Since he came to the league. They try to make him say his name was Toby. I'm glad he helped orchestrate the upset last week against Tennessee,
yes,
although that was a divisional game. But in all honesty, the Tyrod Taylors of the world end up on top simply because they outlast everybody. And that brother has had everything done to him. A doctor stabbed him in the damn chest with a knife.
Yes,
I mean, the kind of stuff that you'd think you was talking about 12 years a slave, or at least 60 minutes a slave. But, you know, time out to get here. I'm glad about that.
Same.
So now we are at the point where it is time for everybody to give their final thoughts. And if they wish to do so, please offer up what they're thankful for. I thank everybody for coming in and offering a little dessert prior to we getting our Thanksgiving menu and Detroit getting their ass whipped on national television. So we start with Brother Farah. Patrick, if you would.
Guys, and today in a paper in New Jersey, it's a devastating, it's something I predicted happened in college football. It's a major story about how Rutgers answered tough questions about race recruiting black football players. And what they've done, they did a very nice, I know the guy is named Todrick Hunt, his brother in South Jersey. He made an exclusive article on recruiting black players and how the ideas, what I said before, because all these clowns making all these laws about black players and certain states not being able to feel free where they're going. They used a classic case of a young man named Gebbert Winstreth. He's from Owensburg, Kentucky. He's one of the top five quarterbacks in the country that were being recruited. He got recruited by everybody, Kentucky, Alabama, all over. He chose to go to Rutgers in New Jersey. And the reason that they did is because his parents asked him questions. And here's some of the questions the parents were asked about their son. They wanted to know, will my son be safe off and on the campus? He can be heard in the locker room as a black man. If he tweets a Black Lives Matter and takes a knee on protest, will he be hampered by it because he sees police brutality? They just have to worry about if being stopped by a cop. In the school community of football, watches, if you have any black coaches on the squad that are progressive. And lastly, what steps is the college going to take to ensure he succeeds academically and socially? And lastly, what kind of haircut can my son have? Fellas, it's being addressed now. Certain states eventually ain't going to get certain black ball players. These states will have all these laws that you can't teach, you know, you can't have a black culture, a black identification. It's going to happen. And this article pointed out black and white big time today.
That's impressive, my brother. Definitely happy Thanksgiving to you and yours. What do you have to be thankful for?
Me? Just to be alive and kicking. That's all. Alive and kicking. I've been blessed to have my health, thank goodness. That's the greatest thing you can have. And happy to be in a situation where I can bring my guys to discuss stuff because, believe me, we're all in places where we can't do this wherever we are.
That's true. Thank you, brother, for that. And now, the professor, we will take a brief commercial to recognize the Black College Sports Encyclopedia. Give yourself some black history for the holidays. Some great stuff put together by Professor and his staff. Always detailed, always on point. Orders are being taken now. See him at www.blackheritagereview.com, the Black College Sports Encyclopedia. And now, the star of the show, Professor Fred.
And that's the Black College Sports Encyclopedia, history of HBCU football, the history of Nelson Brownlee and the Claflin Pantherettes, and the Livingston Blue Bears, who was in, it tells us everything going back to the beginning of HBCU football on Livingston's campus in 1892, which is now getting a new blue, black and blue feel to their much to the chagrin, but it's about time. It's a great thing, and it's being done by another HBCU great, Willa Lanier, and his foundation, who's put in several fields already, and are doing more coming up over the next year. One of the ones they finished is Central State out in Ohio. And Hovey Field in Richmond. I don't know. I halfway hate to see that one happen, not because Union beat Winston last night in the basketball tournament, but because everybody who ever played on Hovey Field or marched in the band on Hovey Field, they know about it can be 90 degrees and no rain, nowhere, but the field was always muddy. And so that's part of history. But anyway, you know, it's kind of things that I'm thankful for. One is the verdict today down in Georgia.
Yes,
I say one of the things that, you know, when I was asked about why wasn't there more of a ruckus when with this young man up in Wisconsin or wherever it was, Minnesota. Well, one thing, he shot white boys, which seemingly nobody seemed to notice. He shot white boys. And, you know, it's sad, still a sad commentary because the judge threw, first of all, let's go all the way back. some of the stuff he was should have been charged with, he wasn't. And some of the ones that he should be charging with were not escape proof. So at the end of the day, the judge did what he was supposed to do, threw some of that crap out. And remember, he was tried by a jury of his peers, a bunch of crazy white folks from up north. So at the end of the day, he gets a chance to walk. But, you know, that's why we got to tell our own story, because the young man who was killed down in Georgia was minding his own business. And, you know, that's just one, as they say, that's a microcosm of what goes on around a lot of places. You know, there are times I'll be thinking about that when once I was accosted by an officer three doors from my house who wanted me to tell him what happened at a time when I was probably 150 miles away, you know, heading back from the CIAA tournament. But those kind of things, those are some of the kind of things I'm happy for. Some of our family will be doing podcasts tomorrow from about four different places, but we will be together in smaller groups because my sister can't have a lot of company. So the out-of-towner is going to be there tomorrow. And she's celebrating her 90th Thanksgiving. So, you know, girl got back. Mm-hmm. But anyway, that's what I'm happy about, and that's what I'm thankful for.
All right. Thank you, brother. Big G, your turn, baby.
Well, it is 2021. This will be the first holiday season without immediate family.
Right? Oh, that's right. Oh, my God.
After 2 years of great sorrow, we will survive. Because as they taught me to survive. So we move on, we continue, and we keep on educating the people. Blessing is talking about Second Family. Thank you, Second Family.
Thank you.
You have given me a goal to finish. Also, I want the world to know that before the end of this decade, the Kansas City Chiefs, the Atlanta Braves, the Chicago Blackhawks, we'll have new names. Mark it down. November 24th, 2021. There will be new names for those three teams. There we go, Saturday. And one. And the music box, I don't know yet. Because I still have to work out with the good.
Right. Ain't nothing wrong with that. Great Upper Cove, Saturday, 4 p.m. Eastern, 1 on the Pacific Coast, and a possible music box to be announced later. T-Mac, what you got for us? Tony? Where you at?
You gonna get damaged?
He ain't starting the leftovers
all day. Damn,
we ain't cooked it in here.
Get some cold pizza.
Where you at, T? All right.
See you back.
Well, while he's making his sandwich, let me just briefly say, you know, Gary, I was thinking about what you said when you mentioned Margaret and Pops. You know, I miss her, too. Ma Gray had a way of just looking at me and making me laugh and almost making me, like, pause at the same time. So I think of her lovingly, as well as I think of folks in my family, some who I will not connect with ever again. But having said all of that, I'm grateful I can get to the bathroom without no drama. Doesn't sound like much, but trust me, and aside from everything else, I am grateful for those who are around me, those people on the thread, and being able to do this and still keep my brain going from a creative vein. It's like there's stuff I know I need to get out of me, and as long as I can get it out, I'm okay. So having said all of that, I am thankful for that. I'm also thankful for good collard greens and the simple things in life. So, yes, we are happy with all of that. And Tony, last call for Tony. All right. Well, since Tony is not there, I will pass sentence. And everybody else, enjoy the holiday. Please, when you get the itis, don't worry about it. Just go on to sleep. Don't nobody care. And, as always, do our thing Saturday, 2 p.m., with the stir fry. So you can deal with the leftovers then. For everybody here on the thread, for everybody, if you're traveling, please go safe, stay safe, be safe. Thanks for my girls. And have a good night, y'all. Go safe, stay safe, be safe. Wash your hands. Especially if you're cooking. Wash your ass. Yeah. Shit, we don't want no ass gravy on the menu. And of course, we're in mask.
Yeah, he, this court is now in session. His Honor, Judge Pigmeat Mark and Poseidon. Yeah, he, the court of swings is just about ready to do that thing. I don't want no tears, I don't want no lies. Above all, I don't want no alibis. This judge is hip, and that ain't all. He'll give you time if you're big or small. Fall in line, or this court is neat. Peace, brother.
Uh-oh, here come the judge. Here come the judge. Everybody know that he is the judge.
Judge, your ownership high, sir. Did I hear you say order in the court?
Yes, I said order.
Well, I'll take two cans of beer, please.
Remember me?
No, who are you, boy?
Well, I'm the fella that introduced you to your wife.
To my wife?
Yeah.
Life, you son of a gun, you. Come November election time, you vote your way and I vote mine. Case is a tie and the money gets spent. Vote for Pigmeat Mark for president. I am the judge. I am the judge. Everybody knows that I am the judge. I am the judge. I am the judge.
Everybody know I am the judge.